Welcome to the 64th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chow.
And as Kevin Peterson offers his services for free coaching, welcome to the podcast that will be first in the queue.
And so KP's rise from sinner to saint begins. This episode, we are still refusing to talk about the KP fiasco. Instead, we've got all kinds of fun in line for you. We're going to be looking at Test and One Day International cricket, as well as domestic. Well, when I say domestic, that's picking it up a bit, but homegrown cricket, both in England and Australia. I'm going to be talking about the 1981 disgrace. We're going to be reviewing Graham Lloyd's How's That? The Six Sixes Ball Mystery and debating whether Kumar Sangakkara should go back and play for Sri Lanka again. So what's caught your eye over the last couple of weeks?
Well, at a time when everyone else seems to be focused on World Cup preparation, Pakistan, in their own way, have just been playing loads of Test cricket in the UAE. It was great fun watching them dismantle Australia, but it did leave a lot of people thinking that perhaps home advantage in the UAE is almost so great as to render series there almost pointless. I mean, you know, you remember England going there a couple of years ago and it was embarrassing.
Painfully, yeah.
The conditions are, they seem to suit Pakistan's batsmen incredibly well, Pakistan's spinners incredibly well. But I think New Zealand have gone a long way to disproving that with a very gutsy showing in the second test. They've really proved that visiting teams can be competitive there. The recipe wasn't too surprising. Their batsmen were very patient. They treated the spinners with respect, but not fear. And their seamers, who let's be honest, you know, no disrespect to New Zealand, you know, Trent Bolt and Tim Southey aren't, you know, the most feared seamers in world cricket. But they stuck at it, made very good use of the new ball. And the second test finished as a very evenly poised draw. You know, New Zealand, I think, were actually ahead of the game for much of it.
I think it's interesting what you say about respect but not fear, because there, as you say, there's been this sort of mystique that's grown up around Pakistan playing in the UAE. And actually, you kind of get the sense that a lot of teams have sort of talked their way out of being able to play the spinners at all by the time they get there. And in a sense, there was just a really sort of down-to-earth honesty about the way the New Zealanders played this test that was quite refreshing. Now, you said you've been avoiding the warm-up for the World Cup, and I've been relishing it by being able to watch the Australia-South Africa series. In a sense, this is just a standalone one-day series, and in a sense, it is just a warm-up for the World Cup. But actually, it's turned into a really interesting series as well. There are all these little sort of internal dramas, I suppose, going on in each of the teams in around who's going to stake their claim for the World Cup. Pat Cummins has looked really great for Australia opening the bowling. And Farhad Bahardian, I don't even know if that's how you pronounce his name, but has been really impressive in the South African mid order. And you just think that when you put him together with AB de Villiers when he's back, that's going to be a really strong one. And then there have just been some great games as well. So actually, as we record the end of the final one there at the SCG, just about 300 metres away from where I'm now sitting, I would have been there when recorded this evening. Listeners, we are very dedicated here at Best Web Radio. But it's been quite nice that this series, that could have been just a bit of a random warm-up for the World Cup, has actually turned into a really scintillating round of cricket.
Has it told you anything about probable World Cup favourite? I mean, obviously Australia have had the better of the series, but has it given you a confidence to make a big, bold prediction?
Well, they're both teams in flux, actually, I think, in a way, and they both still have some things to tie down. I mean, the Australian batting actually has been really impressive, and I think with their home advantage, the Australians do look as if they're going to have a really strong chance at the World Cup come 6 months' time, or whenever it is, 5 months' time, 4 months' time, when is it, 3 months' time? Anyway, at some point in the future. But basically what I'm saying is, don't bet anything on the back of my prediction and then sue me if you get it horribly wrong, because it's just so difficult to tell at this stage.
So I guess away from the glamour of international cricket, the ECB this week released the results of their national playing survey, and it showed that the number of people playing recreational cricket in the UK has dropped from 908,000 in 2013 to 844,000 this year. And I think it's been widely pointed to as a sign of real, real problems in the domestic game. And a lot of people have chosen to use it as an excuse to reignite the terrestrial versus Sky TV debate. There's still an ongoing debate over how serious this drop is. Some people have made the point that actually this was slightly wetter summer at times. You know, did that cost it? I think the stat that really caught my attention was that 53% of those interviews said they wish they played more cricket than they currently did. And I think it does point to this thing that, you know, cricket is a game that it does demand commitment, it does demand involvement. And I wonder if it's not a rather unfortunate sign that many cricket lovers are increasingly struggling to fit the game they love into their lives. And I mean, I'm sure we've all played in teams where, you know, that very keen player suddenly has a family, suddenly has to, or frankly, suddenly just has a very demanding girlfriend and, you know, isn't turning up as often. And
we all know that.
Yeah. And I think that side of thing is a little bit disappointing.
The other thing that is quite difficult to know with those stats in isolation is actually whether the club infrastructure is there to enable everyone who wants to play cricket to play cricket. Because, you know, it might just be that there are people who just, you know, there's one team in their local club and they can't get a game, and yet they're really keen, but they're just not good enough to get a game. So it's kind of an interesting figure to just trot out and then use that to prophesy the death of the game, exactly as you say, without any context
right.
to it.
You're quite right, because wish they played more could be, wish they could make the time for it, or could well be, yeah, just wish they got a game. But you've been making the most of the
Australian recreational scene. Yes, indeed. So I play every Sunday morning in a ground called Moor Park that is literally, well, not literally, but is almost in the shadow, metaphorically in the shadow of the SCG. And I play in a 2020 tournament for my work team. And it's a really sort of casual setup. They're 5 ball overs, they're team 8 players aside. And we were playing a game this morning, started at 9 o'clock in order to avoid the worst of the heat. It was about 40 degrees later on this morning. And we scored 130 in our 20 overs, which is a pretty competitive total. And then we realised after the first over of the opposition's reply that we weren't in it with the slightest chance. And it wasn't because we're not a very good bowling team. We are. It wasn't because they were a very good batting side, which they turned out they weren't. It was simply that they had one really, really good batsman. So the first 3 balls of their innings went 4-6-4. And then our saving grace was the fact that you're forced to retire at 50. And this guy reached 50 in about 4 overs, at which point, obviously, they were most of their way on, you know, to their final target. And it just struck me. So we actually came back, got them all out. He got to come back in at the end and ended up batting as the last man standing and then knocked off the final runs like that. But there was literally no way we were ever going to get him out. And there was no way that he wasn't going to score all the runs single-handedly. And there's just this thing that happens, you know, when you just suddenly come up. I like playing competitive cricket, and you can't sort of, you know, just not include people in the side because they're too good. But it really does take something away from the game when you get someone who just basically single-handedly can take on an entire team and win.
What I've never understood is what a player like that gets out of the occasion. I mean, our team had an example early this year where we played a team where it was a Berkshire under 21 player who had been given the opportunity in the other team as like a development thing. He needed some sort of game. And he knocked off 100. And the expectation, certainly in our Sunday games, if you make 100, you retire. And he batted on. And we just thought, what are you getting out of a very good batsman knocking around Sunday medium paces all over the place? It suggests a kind of quite an odd mentality, really. You know, surely you...
Well, I'm not sure it's that uncommon, though. I remember once playing tennis against someone at university, someone who was very good at tennis. I played appallingly. He beat me 6-love, 6-love or something like that. And at the end of the game, I just said to him, look, I'm really sorry. That wasn't much fun for anyone. You know, I should have put up a better fight. And he just looked at me and smiled and said, no, don't worry. I loved it. I love winning.
From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to tell us about a ball bowled in 1981 that outraged the cricketing world.
Well, at least he's not bowling underarm. That's a comment that I overheard the other day when I was walking past a game of club cricket that happened on the park I was just talking about in the shadow of the SCG. And it was in response to a quick and really accurate bowler who was repeatedly bowling bouncers into the body of a batsman, and this batsman clearly just didn't have the ability to cope. And it just made me muse that it's a bit of a strange thing that bowling a ball slowly along the ground could be considered probably the only thing that's worse than actually putting a batsman into physical danger. But that's just the nature of the reaction to what Australia did on that day in 1981, that even Australians playing under the shadow of their iconic home ground still reviled that action. So let's rewind to it. It's 1981, and Australia are playing at home against the New Zealanders in the final of the Benson and Hedges World Cup series. Now, the final of this series consisted of five games, and after two, it was tied at one game apiece, and then the action moved down to the MCG in Melbourne, and the date is the 1st of February. So the Australians batted first, and they posted a pretty competitive 235 for their 50 overs. Now, the New Zealanders, when they bat, they're always slightly behind the rate, but a century from opener Bruce Edgar keeps them in contention, and it's probably now the most overlooked century of all time. They get themselves into the position where they need 15 runs off the final over, and the final over is going to be bowled by Trevor Chappell, who's the younger brother of the captain, Glenn. Now, Richard Hadley's at the crease, and he promises to be the Kiwis hero yet again when he on-drives the first ball for four. But his flourish doesn't last long, and he's LBW's second ball to a delivery that looks if it pitches outside leg, but, you know, he was given out. Those weren't the days of the DRS or any of that nonsense. Now, Ian Smith, who we all know from the commentary, comes in next, and he takes a two off the third ball of the over, and then he takes a two off the fourth ball of the over, which requires then seven are required to win off the last two balls. The next ball, Smith attempts a horrible heave across the line, the kind of shot I play in that situation, and is bowled. So there are still seven left to win, but now the key factor is there are six runs left to tie off the last ball. And the new batsman is Brian McKechnie. And this is the moment where the controversy begins. Glenn Chappell, who's the Australian captain, instructs his brother, Trevor, to bowl the ball underarm along the round, completely obliterating any chance of a six being hit. He gives the instruction to his brother, and then the umpires are informed, and then the umpires pass on the message to the batsman. Now, bowling underarm isn't actually illegal in the game at this point, but there's some really interesting footage, and there's obviously loads of footage on YouTube of this. There's some really interesting footage of Rod Marsh, who, when he hears that this is the plan, just shakes his head in disgust behind the stumps. So the ball is then delivered underarm. McKechnie plays a forward defensive, and then he just throws his bat away in disgust as he walks from the field. Ironically, he's later fined for showing dissent for that incident, for throwing his bat away. The end of the game is also a bit odd because it's just completely muted. The Australians just walk off the pitch. There are no, you know, it's been a really close game, but there are no high fives or anything like that. And then Geoffrey Howard, the Kiwi captain, comes out to remonstrate with the umpires in the middle of the square.
That the Australians were clearly not united behind their captain on this, because obviously it, you know, we'll talk about the sort of ethics of it, but it was a very bold decision by the captain, and it's one of those things where I guess in a more unified team you'd almost expect people to close ranks around the captain, but for someone like Rod Marsh to be so obviously dissenting from the plan.
And it reminded me of, I mean, and it's not the same because it's not quite such a conscious captain decision, but it is a conscious decision. When Stuart Broad refused to walk against the Australians last summer at Trent Bridge, summer before last at Trent Bridge, when he was clearly out, you know, when he gloved it to first slip or whatever it was, and he refused to walk and the umpire didn't give it, he was making a conscious decision there. And the whole England team, and I'm sure there are people in the England team who would have thought you really should have walked, but they didn't say anything, and there was this closing of ranks, exactly as you say. But from the very outset, the entirety of the Australian cricket establishment came out and said what happened was wrong. So Richie Bellew in the commentary described the event as disgraceful. Ian Chappell, who was commentating on the game, who is of course brother of Glenn, said, "No, Glenn, you can't do that." And then the New Zealand Prime Minister came out and described it as the most disgusting moment I can recall in the history of cricket. And then the Australian Prime Minister got involved and called the acts, quotes, contrary to the traditions of the game.
We've had a lot of discussions on this podcast about the spirit of cricket. Does it exist, or is it just a good PR thing that cricket does? But this incident is interesting in that to use that sort of language, disgusting, disgraceful. If we were talking about football or any other sport, we'd probably be talking about, you know, something like the Luis Suarez bite, you know, an act of almost violence or something. You know, that would be the kind of act that would get a word of disgusting used. I mean, here what we've had is a legitimate tactic, well, maybe not legit, a legal tactic used by a captain to win a game, and people are calling it disgusting and disgraceful. It does say an awful lot about how this belief that cricket must be played in a certain way and how strong that belief is.
And I think particularly at this time, the world of cricket was in a really interesting place, because this is in 1981. It's post-Packer, so the move from kind of amateur to professional cricket is firmly underway. And there are all of these debates about, you know, how you play the game, why you play the game, the spirit of the game. They're all being redefined at around that time. There's a really interesting interview with Greg Chappell. I think I was calling him Glenn Chappell for a while, but of course he's not Glenn Chappell at all. Glenn Chappell, of course, being the English cricketer, Greg Chappell being the Australian cricketer. It's what comes with being an Englishman in Australia. You get confused about these things. Greg Chappell, who was the Australian cricketer, the cricketer we're talking about in this story, does an interview with the ABC later, and he just says his mind was completely frazzled. He wasn't in the right frame of mind to be a captain at the time, and that all of the extra burdens that he had to undertake as a captain at that time, of the off-field going to meeting, selection, PR, all that, left him unable to actually make a proper decision. But at the same time, as well as just mental exhaustion, I think there's something a bit more fundamental that's going on here, which is that just as, you know, the spirit of cricket was being rethought, so too the role of the captain was being rethought. And, you know, in the professional age, a captain's as much as a kind of manager of a business as he is just an on-field cajoler of a few cricketers. And I suspect that might have been something that was just sort of playing on Chappell's mind at the time, and actually, you know, sort of divorced him from the reality of the decision that he was making. I think the other thing is, you know, Australian captains are always known for being hard-nosed and all of these other things. And Chappell just fundamentally misjudges what it means to be hard-nosed, what it means to be a sort of a hard captain. And, you know, he's also captain of the other consideration is that he's captain of a team that is really in the doldrums at the time. They're really not winning games. And so I suspect this is the other thing on his mind when he makes this decision, is simply win at all costs. I've got to win.
The hard-nosed point is really interesting because of the fact that it is the Australian brand of cricket, do what you need to do. But this incident does suggest, I guess, that there is a limit to that. Because presumably, in your view, Australian fans were opposed to this decision? You know, was their reaction similarly negative or...?
That they were. They booed. I mean, the New Zealand fans obviously were more vociferous in the opposition. But the Australian fans were certainly not fans of this decision. And actually, you know, fundamentally the reason for that is that when you watch that over again now, it's really compelling cricket. The whole game compelling cricket. You know, it's come to the last over. Six off the last. It's what the stuff that legend is made of. And What Chappell does is he just completely destroys the drama. He completely destroys the reason that we watch cricket, which is for these reasons. He obliterates things. It's like having, you know, a bad ending to a really good novel, really appalling spectacle.
It also comes down to this problem that cricket is both contest and entertainment. And what he did to win the contest, to guarantee victory in the contest. And there will be, and I mean, we probably all know these people, these fans, for whom that is actually all that matters. But cricket has always had an awful lot. One of the things that makes it such a great game is so many supporters and fans of the game, they love the contest. That actually often matters more to them. That they love the entertainment. That actually often matters more to them than who won at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, I mean, the short-term result of all of this was that underarm bowling was banned by the ICC, which actually brought international regulations into line with the long-standing rule in English county cricket, which had been around for a while, banning underarm bowling. But I think the other thing is, and going back to what you were saying, is that this was a really salutary reminder at a point when cricket was at a bit of a crossroads, when it, you know, could have done gone into a completely commercial win-at-all-costs kind of direction. It was a really salutary reminder to captains and to cricketers and to coaches and to fans that winning at all costs wasn't at all acceptable. And so, ironically, I wonder whether actually Greg Chappell's moment of madness might actually have been quite a good thing in the history of the game for that reason.
Thank you.
The book review, and for this episode, we have been reading How's At? The Six Sixes Ball Mystery by Graham Lloyd. Now, to sort of mercilessly summarise the biography in the back of the book of Graham Lloyd, he's been a freelance broadcaster and journalist for more than 30 years. He's the author of 8 books, which are across a range of subjects, from including mostly cricket and football. And he has a company called Celluloid, which makes TV documentaries, one of which sounds quite interesting, is about Hugh Morris, English cricket's managing director. And he's also made one about Ewan Evans, the ex-Welsh rugby captain. Andy, tell us a bit about the book.
This book really begins at an auction in Christie's in 2006, when a cricket ball was sold for £26,400. The reason being was that it was supposedly the ball that Gary Sobers hit for 6 consecutive sixes in Swansea back in 1968. Graham Lloyd, however, is convinced that this was not the actual ball. And what follows in How's At is his determined investigation to prove that, and to find out also about the origin of the ball that was sold at Christie's. What you can say about this book is it is an extremely good example of determined investigative journalism. I mean, I get extremely wound up with so much sports journalism now that is so-and-so has posted something nasty on Twitter and then an article is written about that. The meticulousness of Lloyd's fact-checking harkens back to sort of an older era of journalism where it really was about sort of getting to the truth. And the way he proves that the ball sold at Christie's isn't the ball used is actually quite impressive. You know, there's the use of video footage, interview material, lots of historical documents. It's really what investigative journalism at its best should be about.
When I first picked up this book, I have to say I read the first 2 pages, which set out the situation: ball sold at auction for an awful lot of money. Is it the real one? ? And then you look at the kind of the length of the book, which runs to 232 pages. And the first question, and I think I actually said this to in an email to you shortly after I'd started it, was, is there any way that this can be sustained over this many pages? And in fact, the answer is yes, it can be. There is an astonishing, as you say, there's an astonishing amount of evidence here. And actually, there are parts of the stories that are really quite compelling. There are characters who have sort of walk-on roles as well. There's some quite interesting. I mean, I thought Gary Sobers' agent, or agent as then was and now claims not to be his agent, is quite an interesting character. And there is quite a sense of there being something a bit sort of novelistic about this whole thing. And it's not just about sometimes about the hard facts of, is this the ball, isn't it? It's established very early on that it isn't the ball that was hit for 6 sixes. And in fact, it's all about trying to convince the world about this. I do, though, sometimes worry that the weight of evidence gets a little bit much, sometimes things are backed up by facts, which are backed up by more facts, which are backed up by more facts. And you can sort of see why Lloyd's doing it, because he really wants to make his case watertight. But it does sometimes get a little bit repetitive, and you sometimes wonder whether the 232 pages might have been condensed a little bit more.
Lloyd's writing style is extremely factual, and it's extremely sort of, you get a very precise blow-by-blow account of how he launched his investigations and how he proceeded with them. And it is interesting, that level of detail, but it also means that this book is a long way away from, I guess, some of the cricket writers who we have particular affection for, the Hamiltons, Hayes of this world, who allow themselves a bit more flair. And I think, to be honest, with a bit more editing, this could have been made a little bit more, a little bit tighter. It could have had a pace that would have allowed it to whip on a little bit more. I think, again, going back to it as an example of good journalism, I like the getting an insight into Lloyd's box of tricks, basically. I really enjoy seeing how when a lead goes cold, how he comes up with a different strategy. I mean, there's a lovely bit when he gets a friend of his who's working closely with him on the investigation to pose as a businessman to make contact with this Indian collector. And I think it is quite enjoyable seeing that sort of detective work at play, those clever strategies for getting through to people.
So in the interest of kind of editorial transparency, I think we probably both have to admit that neither of us actually got to the end of this book. And I feel that if we're going to review this on air, then we should probably own up to that. But I think there's a reason that we didn't get to the end of that, which is that, you know, there are times when it does feel like a little bit of a slog. And so while it's definitely, you know, it's a fascinating tale and it's an amazing body of evidence and an amazing chronicle,
I do, and I would recommend it on that basis personally. I do think that as a reader, you probably need sort of the same level of perseverance that Graham Lloyd had when he was following through his quite remarkable quest.
And finally, to the debate, and this episode we are asking, should Kumar Sangakkara listen to Sri Lanka's requests and agree to postpone his retirement from Test cricket? So the background for this is that Sangakkara, who's already retired from T20s, has said that after the World Cup next year, he will retire from all forms of cricket. And the Sri Lankan board and Angelo Matthews have both asked him to reconsider and play on in Test cricket. There are a lot of young players coming through, and they've also just lost Mahela Jayawardene, so they are really keen for Sangakkara to stay on in the Test team.
These situations where experienced players retire and just leave basically a massive gap in a team really aren't unheard of. Obviously, you know, teams go through sort of transitions and fluxes all the time. What's quite interesting with this one is there kind of is an established path for those players in terms of going into a coaching setup and becoming part of, well, becoming mentors through that. And what I think kind of needs defining with Sri Lanka is whether basically they want his runs, because he's, you know, average whatever it is, over 78 in 2000,
yeah.
78, I mean, ridiculous, 78 in tests in 2014, whether they just want his runs or whether they are genuinely thinking that they want him there in some kind of mentoring capacity. And frankly, you can quite understand if they do just want, you know, a batsman, the best, must be the best test average, surely, yeah, of 2014, that they presumably for that reason don't want him to go. But that in and of itself isn't a good enough reason to keep him in there. You know, his experience can be got through a coaching role, really, I would say.
I think a lot of it comes down to Sangakkara has been a fantastic servant to Sri Lanka. Does he owe them anything more? Because you feel like he is obviously in great form. He isn't retiring because the runs have dried up, because he's finished as a batsman. I think he's retiring because, he's got to a stage in his career where he'll be 37
next year. He wants a life, probably.
Yeah, I think he just wants to move on the end. And I do think there is probably something to be said for the Sri Lankan board and Angelo Matthews as captain probably respecting that and saying, you know, he's been a great servant of the game. If he's ready to go, you know, maybe he's ready to go.
And we see too often when players just carry on, and, you know, they're at their best, they don't quit at their best, they want, you know, they want the glory days to continue forever, and they end up either being dropped or, you know, like punting, and just, which just became such a kind of farce. And it's such a sad thing when you see these great players who just play on for too long. But then again, on the other hand, there is an argument that the Sri Lankans have lost a whole load of really experienced players recently, and that they, you know, they do need some kind of sense of continuity that's going to keep them going. So, I mean, you can kind of understand their kind of knee-jerk reaction being, let's just keep this going for longer and longer. But what you would need, if he were to keep on going, you would hope that there was some kind of, I hate the phrase game plan, but some kind of game plan, some kind of strategy in place, which was, okay, we're going to use you for another 6 months, and after that 6 months, then we're going to be in a position where we can, where he can retire, and he cannot leave a massive, massive hole in the setup.
The difficult thing about all these transitions is that at some point, there has to come a time when the young players do become the seniors, where suddenly they are batting number three, they are batting number four, and they are having to make the runs. And however long you get the senior players, the Sangakkaras, to stay around, you can't prevent that. There will come a time where they've, you are only just delaying the inevitable. I guess the only thing is here, maybe there is a case that, I think Tendulkar and Ponting are both great examples of players who batted well beyond their peak, frankly. You know, they were not the same batsmen by the end. There is maybe an argument here, though, for someone sort of saying to Sangakkara, look, you are in such good form, why not see how long this can go? You know, I guess the decision has to be personally up to him. It's like, is he still enjoying his cricket and stuff? But, you know, there is a little part of me that thinks, is it a waste to go out when you're still scoring at 78? You know, what more could you do? You know, there are batsmen who have kept playing the game to a very effective level late into their 30s, and maybe Sangakkara can be one of those, if he wants to be.
So that was the 64th? Was that the 64th
that
episode
was
of WrestleMania?
The
64th
episode,
the 64th. They all blur into one when they get into such high figures. That was the 64th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. Coming to you, I was about to say live from London and Sydney, recorded live from our respective bedrooms in Paddington, London and Paddington, Sydney. How's that for intercontinental synchronicity?